The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2019 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2019. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and the ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
All right, my timekeeping sensibilities suggest to me that it's time to get underway, so I will try to honor my own timekeeping sensibilities and get underway. I am Chris Schlecht. I am at New St. Andrews College. I have been involved in classical Christian education for my entire professional life that goes back pushing 30 years now, and I've spent a lot of time in high school education. I continue to be engaged in high school education in a variety of ways, although my day job is with college students. This is a vision for the everyday classroom, and there is an outline on in the notebook. Does somebody have the page number? 160 is the page number. There's also a handout. And if you got a handout when you came in, then you are completely outfitted. If you did not get a handout when you came in, I understand that we've run out and there are more handouts that are forthcoming. And so we'll see to it that we can get them distributed. I had the privilege of returning to the high school classroom last year, and I'm going to show you a test question that I assigned to 10th graders. Here. So this was the essay question on a test. How did World War II affect women on the home front? Formulate a thesis and support it using this magazine advertisement from the New Yorker, March 13th, 1943. Because I'm the nerd that I am, I actually go through old magazines and find things like this. This is not an image that the students had seen. It's something that they were unacquainted with. But this was the test question. I also, when it was in the test form, because I'm sure you can't see what the text is on that advertisement, the text says, "You too, like thousands of other women, can do men's work without sacrificing one bit of feminine loveliness. The secret is to ensure a lovely line be fitted to a form fit, tailored to precision, foundation, girdle, or bra. The better stores have them." And my 10th graders did pretty well with this. Now let me, so this was a test question that I administered to 10th graders. I want you to think about what it is that students would need to do or to have done in order to prepare to succeed in this essay. Just think about that. And I'm going to show you another test, and I'm going to ask the same question about the other test, and we're going to compare. All right, so here's another test. I don't expect for you to see in the overhead the small print that'll appear to you, but this is from a classical Christian school, an actual test that was actually graded. The student got 100%. European History, Chapter 7, test. And I'll put the same question. What is it that a student needed to do in order to prepare to succeed on this test? And so coming in here, we've got some great questions. So number 15, the guy who excommunicated Theodosius. Oh, that's Ambrose. Bishop of Hippo, number 16. Apparently, there was only one Bishop of Hippo. Number 10, the one at the top. Book showed Rome's fall due to sin. That's what, most scholarly Latin father. Now, what this indicates to me is the student had been trained when presented with this stimulus, this is your response. Stimulus, response. Stimulus, response, same test. So there was a matching section on this test. Here's the dates and here's the events. And bonus, this is why the student scored more than 100. In what year did Leo the Front confront Attila? I like this. So apparently there was some images. Bottom question there. List the four features of the Hagia Sophia's core structure. The four features. The five pillars of Islam. This is great. Let's see. You can just see. Okay. I like this essay question. What were the reasons for the fall of Rome? This is every bit as much of a quick fill-in-the-blank answer as the other one. So it's a perfunctory, these are the reasons. When presented with this stimulus, this is the response. Now, somewhere, somebody thought that this is an essay question when it's fundamentally no different than that fill-in-the-blank, Bishop of Hippo, Augustine, the reasons for the fall of Rome are these reasons. And this student apparently got a perfect score because he listed the ones that he was told to. I call this, once again, intellectual bulimia, where you binge and vomit. And then the real charade is that the teacher will think that the students are really learning because the students perform well on the test. What do you think? Students are being trained like seals to get the fish when there's the prompt and the command versus anyway, I could go on and on. I think this is different. Students had never seen this image before. Okay. And the student needs to come up with a claim, interrogate a source that they haven't seen before, interrogate that source, find something in that source that will support the claim that they invent or devise. There's some background knowledge that they need to have. It's also demonstrating a skill of interrogating a source. Wouldn't you suggest it? Because it's something a little bit different. And I'd like you to think in terms of what it is, the work that you want the students to undertake in order to succeed. This requires a different kind of work to have prepared. In fact, sometimes students get frustrated. What info am I supposed to binge? Because I'm preparing to vomit. Sometimes the info won't help. I want you to demonstrate for me that you can make an argument and that you can recognize an opportunity for an argument when the opportunity might present itself. That's what I want the students to do. So what did the lesson... Oh, there it is here. So, of course, now that was a test question. Let me tell you one of the things that I actually did with my students prior to that test. So what's kind of lesson planning, class discussion? I'll just describe one day in class that was like a week prior to when they were interrogated, when they confronted that test question. Okay, so in the backdrop of that test, I spent some time with images like this, and the students would walk into class, and they're confronted with this. They'll see this slide as they're coming into class. Agree or disagree, a consequence of World War II for women is this. The presence of women in the workforce eroded conventional beliefs about the differences between men and women. And so can anyone identify this sort of iconic character? Okay, very good. Oh, well, I've got your attention here. If you did not get a handout, can you please raise your hand? We've got extra copies here. Oh, did you make enough? All right, just keep your hands up. I'm going to keep on moving here, but that's her cue. Because we've run out of handouts. So, all right. So Rosie the Riveter, is she a guy? She'd strike you as... Well, look at her. Is she masculine? Or is she feminine?
Depends on what she wants.
Look, and you got to look at the image. You can imagine, I'm going to sort of talk over you, but you can imagine the conversation that I would elicit from the students. Here I am. I'm in the Pacific Northwest. This is the Boeing factory with a Rolls-Royce Merlin engine being installed in a fighter plane. And coming back to this question, presence of women in the workforce eroded conventional beliefs about differences between men and women. What do you think? Is this masculine? And we'd have that, we'd continue to have that discussion. Another image, recruiting posters for women in the military in World War II. She looked masculine to you. Is it a woman? What features? And I'd have the students tell me, okay, what, and then justify your answer. Point to something in the image. 10th graders can do that. Point to something in the image. Is it masculine? Is it feminine? Why? What in the image is it? And I might mention that in order to draw women into the military in World War II, they hired top fashion designers to create feminine lines. So you can see in the, look at this. Does that look like a man's outfit? Does she strike you as masculine? This is a recruiting poster to bring women into the army. Be like men. Is that the appeal? And again, imagine this is a 50-minute class period. The students would be engaged in discussion here. And it gets even more, these are almost like pinup girls to become a nurse. And not just recruiting posters, but this is Q-Tex nail polish advertisements from the 1940s. For whichever branch of the service you are, it's your nails good for the uniform and good for the evening gown. So join the military and be like men. Is that the message? Okay, and the kids can see this. Elizabeth Arden actually made a new hue of lipstick to make it match the epaulets on magazines. It's called Montezuma Red. In World War II. And the kids can discuss this. Coming back to this question, now this is one of my favorite legacies of World War II. Masculine or feminine? Okay, obviously feminine. Why? And I'd make the students explain why. I'd make the student point to specific things. And the students can do that, and that's fun, because this is an activity for athletics where they are yelling and leading cheers. That is an inherently masculine activity, isn't it? Cheerleaders are male. In 1940, we all knew that. They'd been that way for generations. This is an athletic event, an athletic contest. Cheerleaders are male. Masculine, but when the men go off and fight in the Japanese in the Pacific or the Nazis in Europe, we have somebody who needs to lead those cheers. Yelling and leading cheers, it's man's work, right? Or do they overcompensate for the fact that they're occupying a new social space to make sure that we understand that this masculine role is occupied by women to differentiate themselves? And I think we're all familiar with, do they look like guys? This is, now we're in Athens here, or we're near Athens here, so University of Georgia. We think of cheerleaders as female today. That's a legacy of World War II. At the end of the class period, presence of women in the workforce eroded conventional beliefs about the differences between men and women. That was a day in class, and like the last 5 minutes, as I design a lesson, I mentioned this in an earlier section, as I design a lesson, I always put most of my planning into the last 5 minutes of the class. Why do I do that? Because we're going to get into a big discussion, and I'm going to get into it, Lord willing, the students will get into it, And if I'm in the midst of a point, or the students are in the midst of a point, and then the bell rings, it's all gone, right? Because I was into it. But if I plan the last 5 minutes, I'm giving myself the off-ramp, the exit ramp, which I need sometimes to discipline myself to make sure I've already planned my route. And so, oh, and my gaze is up at the clock. There's no clock here, but my gaze is up at the clock. 5 minutes left. I need to go to the off-ramp. Okay, everyone at your seats, you're going to just give me a paragraph on this and then hand them in. You're out the door. I think it's really important to plan the last 5 minutes because you need to redeem all of that time that you spent in the first 50 minutes and make sure it's sealed, rather than it just leaks out when the bell rang, interrupting the mid-thought. You know, make the last 5 minutes is necessary to make sure the first 50 minutes gets locked. Okay? And because if the first 50 minutes goes well, I'm going to be into it, and I'll be interrupted by the bell unless I've prepared ahead of time for what exit I'm going to take. So that's why I have to plan the last 5 minutes. And this is already up there in the holster, ready to give the students. So that's what the lesson looked like. That was one day in class that prepared them for that test question that I gave you. Okay. Oh, and so what did the lesson plan look like? So this is how the sausage is made behind the scenes. Okay. So my lesson plan includes, this is my slides dripping over to the bottom here, but it's got information content, skill cultivation, which is something that I always am sure to put in my lesson plan, and I'm going to talk about that more later. So the students will identify and describe the impact of wartime mobilization upon the culture of the United States. Good, good, good. And then skills. Students will do something that is a skill regardless of what information we're talking about. They will study photographs for the historical information they present. They will interrogate mass-produced images for their cultural meanings, identify connections between various historical trends, and describe them. Those are skills. Now, how do you impart skills? How do you impart skills? Well, how did Cal Ripken become a good infielder? Over and over and over and over again. Over and over and over again. Now, come back to that test, that European history test that I put up for you. I'd like you to think about a diet of practice that other test represents. The students are cultivating skills. You are practicing something. Are you practicing the right things or not? The students in that other test learned a certain pattern or modus operandi of how to deal with history. You memorize stuff and you vomit it back on the test. You memorize stuff and you vomit it back on the test. And they get really good at that. Regardless of the content, there's some skills that are being inculcated by the repetition of the task. Do you want it to be bounding balls to the infielder to throw the guy out at first base, or do you want a different task? Which task do you want? If you want the students to reason and to approach materials in a certain way, then think about the skills, the repeated practices that you're giving them, independent of the content. You see what I'm getting at? I'm too often we think about the home front in World War II and info about the home front of World War II, and we lose track of the habits and practices that form the intellectual discipline and culture and formation of the person in the process. I would suggest to you that other test that I showed you is forming a person, not how you want them to. But yes, they understood that Augustine was the Bishop of Hippo. Big achievement. But how about if a student can confront an image that they've never seen before, identify something in it, and connect it with something that they know, and actually form an argument? Can they do that? How do they do that? By practice. And by practice, it's a skill, it's a habit, it's an intellectual discipline. All right? Which has nothing to do with the particulars of World War II. Do you understand? I hope you understand here. My notes are way up here. Got away from my notes. But that's the point. I want to help you to distinguish good lessons from poor ones. And I've given you some thoughts already about how to do it. I'd suggest to you this, and this is what you see on the outline. The difference between a good lesson and a poor one is not discerned by watching the activity that the teacher performs. The difference is discerned always in the activity that the students are performing. Teaching is about getting students to do the work of learning, and when I do classroom observations, my eyes are fixed on what the students are doing far more than what the teacher is doing. If they're not doing the work, if they're not the ones who are exercising agency, if it's not their interest that's aroused, their curiosity being piqued, and their performance being identified, you know, if it's what the teacher's doing, well, who knows if the students are learning? All right, I think we've got more handouts here. Please raise your hand if you need handouts. Thank you very much for our helpers here to bring more handouts. Yes. Thank you so much. They're great. All right, in order to get at this, here we go. So there it is. Here's a different lesson plan. When I saw this lesson plan come in to a school, I knew that this was going to be a poor lesson. I knew it was going to be a poor lesson. Now this is a different subject area. Wednesday, we're going to cover Kingdom Animalia, Phylum, Cnidaria, Propharia, and all this other stuff that a history guy like me doesn't really understand. But so the lesson plan is the information that I'm going to dispense. Whose activity is being described in this lesson plan? The teachers. It's a poor lesson plan. And I'll sit in on this lesson. And the teacher actually went into their preparation thinking, what am I going to do? And that's the wrong question. What are they going to do? What are they going to do? What are they going to do? That's how you're going to tell whether or not the lesson is good. Now, I'm assessing this, and my assessment is, what are the students going to do when I look at this lesson plan? Passive, inert, sit and listen. What are the students going to do? And what habits? Do you see what I'm getting at here? It's a poor lesson plan. Here's the content I'm going to cover in my preparations. And so what's happening in the classroom is all about me. I remember my first lesson evaluation when I was a young teacher. I was in my mid-20s, and I still remember the lesson. I actually still have the notes of it. I keep it in a file. It was on the medieval papacy. And the principal was going to come in and observe my first observation. And I knew he was going to be in there the next day, and so I was going to pull out the stops, best foot forward. And so I really planned. And I still remember I talked about Boniface VIII and Innocent III. I was engaging. I had amusing anecdotes. I started that lesson, and I wrote some things on the board, and then I would continue on with my engaging anecdotes and interesting connections, and I would write something else on the board. And of course, by the time I got to the end of it, the board was this pristine, well-ordered, connected, you know, point, sub-point thing. It all just, you know, was so nicely tailored on the board. I remember that was a morning class, and I went in to the teacher's room over lunch. In my little pidge box cubby there was the evaluation from the principal, and the word on the top was unsatisfactory. That was my lesson evaluation. Unsatisfactory. First lesson evaluation I got, and met with the principal afterwards, and the principal sat down and told me, and he actually had the audacity to have paid far more attention to what the students were doing than what I was doing. And I had imagined that whole interchange in terms of what I'm doing in the classroom. That's what teaching is, and so my preparation is all about what I'm doing. It was a horrible lesson. He was exactly right. I needed to undertake a Copernican revolution of, you know, moving from this geocentric to a heliocentric orientation. The students are doing the work, and whatever the students are doing is going to be the litmus of whether or not you've got an effective lesson. All right. This is a setup for failure. If your lesson plans look like this, recalibrate. So, and I think the lesson plan that was on the slide is that in the handout too? Yes. So that slide, the lesson plan there, you see it on page 4 of the handout there. So I'll return your attention to now the handout that you've received. Information, I want you to look at the lesson plan on page 4, at the bottom of page 4. That's where I am here, bottom of page 4. The students will, and here's the information content, identify and describe the impact of wartime mobilization upon the culture of the United States. And skill cultivation, the students will do these things, and I'm looking for these. So I want the students to perform information, and I want the students to actually exercise certain muscles. Habits, right? And then there's the description of the activity. That's what the lesson plan is. Notice that my objectives are not framed in terms of what I will cover. Lessons are always framed in terms of students are going to do this, students are going to do that, students are going to do whatever it is. It's about the students. I use that language of the students will, or the students will be able to, usually as a reminder to myself about whose activity I need to be planning for, whose actions, who are the actors who need to perform something in the classroom. It's them. And so the teacher's job is to machinate, manipulate, architect a situation to get the students to do something. That's what lesson planning does. Okay? All right. So as we analyze this, now moving down in the notebook outline here, to guide us through this, we need to distinguish between information, habit formation, and character formation. And I've already been anticipating this point here. Information is knowledge bits. What were the dates of the Peloponnesian War? What's the atomic number of carbon or its atomic mass? Sometimes information can be more sophisticated. You know, what factors played into changing Elizabeth Bennet's mind with respect to Mr. Darcy? But this is information. I think you instinctively know what I mean by information, but it's parsing it out and distinguishing it from habits and character formation that I think is going to be helpful as we think about objectives and what really it is that we're aiming for in good lessons. Habit formation is about repeated behaviors. Behaviors that are repeated to the point where they become instinct. When you get into a car, what do? Put on the seatbelt, key in the ignition. Do you think about it? No. You guys know what habits are, right? We talked about how a major league infielder would collect bounding ground balls, scoop it up, throw to first, scoop it up, throw to first, and he gets really good at it at the major league level because he's done that maybe 100 times for every time it occurs in a game. I'd be really curious to know the stats on how many practice grounders a major league infielder fields per grounder he actually deals with in a real game. And of course, I do love baseball. Baseball hits in baseball are like snowflakes. Everyone is unique and different. You know, when a ball coming to a shortstop, it's got a certain pace, a certain angle or trajectory, a certain height of its bounce. That's, you know, no two are alike. No two are alike. Yet at the same time, we all know that muscle memory plays into the craft of scooping that ball up and throw to first, and especially at a major league level, right? We're talking about a habit. What is it that your students do instinctively? What's their intellectual muscle memory when they're confronted with an intellectual challenge? I'll tell you what's happening in your classroom. You are building up muscle memory for something and for some reaction because you are inculcating habits. Whether they're good ones or not, that's up to you. But you are inculcating habits and practices and routines, and you're preparing them either for the better or for the worse of how to react when they're confronted with an intellectual challenge that's maybe a little bit unique and different from something that they've seen in class, but it's got some similarities, just like the grounder that comes to that shortstop in the game, right? So think about those habits. This is the habit formation. Now, coming back to the tale of the two tests that I started this with, I think the one test, both tests have a world of habit formation behind them. Do you see that? And that's where the tests become radically different. Okay, very different tests. Character formation. This gets at our students' inclinations and affections. This gets at the order of their loves. What kinds of people are they becoming? Character formation. Now, I have a hard time reducing this to a lesson plan, but the right kind of habits are ultimately going to stick into when a person is young and the cement of this person is still wet, then the habit formation is ultimately going to become character and their work ethic and the life skills, their capacity for empathy and their loves and their affections and that sort of thing. And that's really what we're after, isn't it? Well, I know this is what you're after because I read your stuff. So, shout out to my friends in Richmond, Virginia. I know that you're into character formation and you're into habit formation because I read your websites. This is good stuff. We exist to glorify God by cultivating students of wisdom and virtue through Christ-centered, academically rigorous education. Our goal is to equip students with the knowledge, skills, and vision necessary to be effective leaders and servants for Christ in a wide variety of professions and vocations. We seek to raise up a generation of young people who have a genuine love of learning, who love Jesus Christ with all their hearts and minds, and who can articulate the Christian message with clarity, creativity, and power. It's a wonderful vision statement. Many of you in your schools have wonderful vision statements. I commend this one to you. It's one of many, many that I can commend to you. Now, my question is this. What does this have to do with what occurs second period Wednesday? What does this have to do with what occurs in second period on Wednesday? Okay. Does it have to do with changing the subject and preaching a sermon and then getting back into World War II? Or is your handling of World War II moving this direction? This is why this talk is called A Vision for the Everyday Classroom. And I'm trying to suggest for you a vocabulary and categories to actually that can take you from here to Wednesday morning's lesson plan. Okay, that's the challenge that I want to try to get to. And I think that character formation, information, habit formation, being able to differentiate those and knowing how they relate to one another will be one of the keys, or the conceptual keys anyway, to getting us there, making a connection between a lesson plan and this. All right, school vision. Let's see. Now, I want to, because we're in Georgia, I want to compliment some of our neighbors here and the schools that I've visited. In order to get into my talk, you need to invite me to your school. So these are schools that I've visited here. But Oxford, Georgia, just up the road here. By God's grace, we endeavor to assist Christian families in the education of their children by providing an academic environment that is distinctly Christ-centered and classical, which is designed to equip students as disciples, scholars, citizens who seek a life of moral and spiritual integrity, personal and social responsibility, and to know and serve the Lord Jesus Christ. This is very good. Now let's talk about World War II. All right, I've got some friends from Pensacola here. We graduate classically educated ladies and gentlemen with abiding faith in whose lives works are joyfully submitted to the Lord Jesus Christ. Now, some schools, and you see this embedded in some of the mission statements, and I'm going to compliment, this is Trinitas here. So this is the same Trinitas, but then they've expanded it here. They've unpacked this a little bit. We aim to graduate young men and women who, now they're starting to move into habits, which I find interesting here. Okay, there's character traits and certain intellectual habits. It's getting a little bit unpacked, and in unpacking it, it's giving us some handles that might start to move us toward helping us in the classroom. So here's the general statement, but Trinitas has actually given further handles that bring us a little closer to the classroom. We aim to graduate young men and women who think clearly and listen carefully with discernment and understanding. Oh, good. These are some intellectual traits now, who reason persuasively and articulate precisely, who are capable of evaluating their entire range of experience in the light of the Scriptures, who do so with eagerness and joyful submission to God. We desire them to recognize cultural influence as distinct from biblical, to be unswayed toward evil by the former. We aim to find them well-prepared in all situations, possessing both information and the knowledge of how to use it. We desire they be socially graceful and spiritually gracious, equipped with and understanding the tools of learning, desiring to grow in understanding, yet fully realizing the limitations and foolishness of the wisdom of this world. We desire they have a heart for the lost and the courage to seek to dissuade those who are stumbling towards destruction, that they distinguish real religion from religion in form only, and that they possess the former, knowing and loving the Lord Jesus Christ. And all these we desire them to possess with humility and gratitude to God. Now, this is lengthy, but if you were to do a little archaeology here, kind of mining this thing, it gives us some handles that might bring us a little closer to the classroom here. Now, but I would suggest further refinement in order to help bring us closer to the classroom. Stonehaven is a school here. You can look at their website. I'm not going to read through the whole thing. But we've got some attributes of students here. And we've got some intellectual habits. Like, look at that fourth bullet point. To listen carefully, reason soundly, speak precisely, articulate persuasively. Next point down, mastered a core body of knowledge and capable of discussing great ideas. And then passion. We've got some habits and character traits blended together. Now, what I'm getting at here is to think about ultimately what we want to create in our students. I told you that at the lesson plan level, you need to think, what are the students doing? You know, that's the question that we usually ask for our mission and vision statements, isn't it? That's the right question to ask for our mission and vision statements. What I'm telling you is that's always the same question to ask about Wednesday morning's lesson plan. Okay? That's the same question to ask in Wednesday. And the frame and the situation is different between a school vision on the one hand and the lesson plan objective on the other. But the key is that there should be some means of reckoning a relationship between the two. And I think the best means I can think of to identify a relationship between the two is to think about habits. You've got the information on the one hand and you've got the character formation on the other. The habits are this in-between ground that are going to help you make those connections. The habits are going to make those connections. I would invite you as faculties, administrators, perhaps get your faculties together, take a look at your school's mission statement, and then unpack it and ask yourself, what kind of intellectual habits do we want to inculcate? What are the repeated behaviors, the skills that we want to see performed again and again and again and again that are at least a gateway to the character development, okay? The habit formation, and that'll help you on those lesson plans. The skill objective here, this is one we've come up with at the college level. It can translate to the high school level just as well, but I think that you should do it with your schools. You don't have to take this one, but I've got this. This is in the outline. Rhetoric, the ability to communicate with clarity, precision, and aesthetic persuasiveness. Dialectic, the ability to draw distinctions and connections, to analyze, synthesize, induce, and deduce. Now, think about those two tests. The test with the woman's undergarment, the underwear test. You can start to see these habits being formed in the underwear test, right? But in the other test, where the fill-in-the-blank test, not so much. Perspective, a humble understanding of oneself and of one's opponents, the limitations of one's own understanding, without that humility leading to relativism. Observation, the ability to pay close attention at various levels of detail. Process, the ability to see a problem and then develop an intelligent process for going about finding a solution. I can tell whether a student's doing that on that test. Students confronted with a problem. Here's an image that I've never seen before. Okay, what can I do with that? That's a problem, and I need to generate some kind of analysis on a piece of paper. How do I get from here to there? You know, can the student break that down into some sort of process? Okay, imagination. This is the creative eye, which is eager to look for new ways of telling the story, of solving the problem. An intellectual curiosity, a habit of copiousness. This test put a student in a new situation. A primary source the student had never confronted before. And how does the student perform then? Okay. Imagination, creativity. It's actually, I think, a more challenging test and a more fun test, as I think you'll find. And ultimately, we want them to form character. And I unpack this also. You see this on your handout. Courage, not a brash fearlessness. So this is the character formation that the habit, back to the habits. The habits are moving toward these character traits. Not brash fearlessness, but a conviction that what must be done or said will be done or said, regardless of what the opposition it will create. Unflustered and undistracted by personal panic or others venting their emotions. Toughness, or we might say fortitude. We should use that word fortitude instead. An intolerance directed towards self for convenient excuses, resulting in perseverance and dependability, a disposition to see trials and challenges as opportunities, and a readiness to assume responsibility. Initiative, the free man's ability to drive himself to complete tasks without a master standing over, the ability to push himself into new ventures without hand-holding, resulting in a desire to be more than an appreciator, but a doer and a creator. Once again, think about those two tests. One of them I don't think is really moving us in that direction, and the other one I think is doing a better job. Intellectual integrity, an intolerance for inconsistencies and a patience for mysteries. Zeal, a godly hunger for the advance of God's kingdom, and evangelical loyalty, a deep and abiding loyalty and confidence in the gospel and the faithful church, a love for God and for neighbor, a hunger for holiness and the fruits of the Spirit. Now, where did I get this, or where do you get something like this? This is taking your mission statement and unpacking it with handles. Take your mission statement, maybe craft your mission statement so that you can give it some handles like this. That's where it comes from. You can take this one and appropriate it if you like, but do it within the context of your school and your faculty to unpack that mission statement so it's got some handles and you can recognize, are we achieving our goal or not, and are we deploying means to achieve our goal? All right. So I want to offer you some other lesson plans that I thought were fun and worked. I use these with 10th graders. All my examples are coming from history classes because that's just me. But I hope many of you can, in your own fields, in your own domains, you know, take what I'm suggesting here. This is my stuff. You need to make it your stuff that's going to get you creative with your students and get them doing. This was a quiz, just to show you what it was like here. Quiz on the suburbs in the 1960s. I called it a quiz because I didn't want the students to freak out. But examine the five primary sources attached. This was given to them in a packet. In a well-crafted essay, assert a thesis statement and defend it using any three of the sources as supporting evidence. Your thesis must be asserting something that was true, important, and unique about American life back in the 50s and 60s. Take care to fully explain how each of the three sources supports your thesis. So that's the instruction. And then five sources, none of which they had seen, but I've reached the point where I expect 10th graders to do this. So this is an advertisement for Levittown suburbs here, and in the handout they can read the text. An advertisement for Lipton soup from Good Housekeeping in the 1950s. This is the front cover of a comic book, and connected with an op-ed piece expressing parental concern about juvenile delinquency and its relationship to horror comics. And so there we have the severed head of a guy who killed his wife in a comic book here. New York Times, 1959 New York Times, Chuck Berry, the rock and roll artist, was arrested for allegedly dating a white girl. Okay, and that's the New York Times article. And then a couple of pages from the manual for a fallout shelter. Those are five sources. What's the task? Choose three to support a thesis. 10th graders could do that. I'm sorry, what's that? Oh, the prompt. Yeah, examine the five sources, and in a well-crafted, I expect you to make an argument, choose any three you want, make an argument, something that's true and unique about the 1950s, and the students could do it. Now, how did I get the students there? Because I confronted the students with sources and with sources again and with sources again, and then they're demonstrating the skill at game time. This is game time and the quiz. And reason, show it to me in the source, whatever claim that you're going to establish. This was my answer key, so I would told them, and as I returned the papers to them with the assessment, I said, okay, here's what I was evaluating you on, and this informs my comments. I told you needed to advance a thesis. Could I find one? Okay, and then this thesis statement must be meaningful. Like, if the thesis statement was, there were anxieties in the 1950s, that's not meaningful because there were also anxieties in the 1850s, the 1750s, and the 1650s, right? So, no, but there were anxieties related to the corruption of youth born of the safety of the suburbs. And that's, you can get the suburbs in there, you can get race in there, you can get, I don't know, there's a lot of ways that students could go, and they did quite well with it, communism. But anyway, so it's got to be a meaningful thesis statement rather than the mere presence of a thesis statement. And then you need to cite three sources, and then what matters about the source is identified and explained. So in other words, you told me something about the source, each one, and then the source wasn't just shoehorned in there, but its connection to your thesis was also drawn up. For each source, I was looking for something in the source and point to the thesis. There you go. And the students can follow, you know, my grading was not some sort of mysterious black box of how I was emote. And the students can follow this. Oh, I see how I didn't do well or how I did better. And I'm coaching them on their skills. I'm coaching them on their skills. Imagine another way of talking about the 1950s. Okay, class, open your notebooks. Heading 1950s, Cold War, and the suburbs. Point one, let me explain to you. Now, that's all about what I'm doing. You can imagine me lecturing through all these points, right, in your lesson plan. Would you want to sit through that, class? Well, maybe if it's me, because I'm an engaging lecturer. But, no, you. Or would you want to be engaged, have discussions, interact with sources, play around with sources, and then you come up to this quiz time, and it's really fun. The kids are, how can they study for this? Well, practice, rather than binging on info dump, right? And sometimes you have to enculturate students away from that, because this is what succeeds. Okay, a certain kind of reasoning. This is, I won't read this, those were actually two students' essays to show you 10th grade level responses that were pretty good. I want to call your attention now to the handout. What I want to suggest for you here, and I think that this, for my purposes, helps to illustrate my point, is actually to illustrate it in terms of demonstration here, rather than me explaining further, for me just to offer, like, here's stuff that I've tried, and keep in mind the principles that we've talked about, and what do you think of these lessons, and hopefully you can maybe take some ideas, maybe you can steal from my lessons, steal from one another, that's what you should do, steal one another's lessons. Good teachers are always going to be on the lookout for stuff to steal from one another, meet up with one another here, exchange ideas. Good teachers will always do that. Take some ideas and say, oh, that won't quite fit, but an adjusted format will fit for you. So that's what I want to do, is to try to make this somewhat practical and hopefully to start a conversation for you to think about lesson plans. So on page one, Indian reservations in the American West. So I have to teach, get into the American West in the 19th century. Again, imagine, okay, I'm going to lecture you on this, and we're going to read an article on Little Bighorn or whatever. Well, here's what I did. I presented the students with two primary sources. One was a letter from a guy who founded the Carlisle Indian School, and another one was a report on boarding schools. And then here's what I gave the students. All right. In groups of four, prepare and perform a skit of 5 to 7 minutes that represents life at a boarding school for the Indian school. Draw inspiration from Richard Pratt's speech, which you have, as well as excerpts from the Merriam Report. In this skit that you prepare in your groups, you need to creatively represent the following issues: white and Indian perspectives, the problems boarding schools aim to solve, and why and how the supporters of boarding schools genuinely believed that these schools would help the Indians, what actually occurred in the boarding schools, and what happened to family life routines and culture back on the reservation. You need to make a skit. And then, so the class is divided up into five groups. Group one, here's your scenario. The Indian family learns that their son or daughter is heading off to the boarding school. They prepare for the son or daughter to depart, and they see him away as he leaves on the bus. And here's the characters in your skit. Make a skit. Group two, the Indian parents travel from the reservation to the boarding school to visit their kid, and they see the school and have a parent-teacher conference. That's your skit. Everyone's got to demonstrate these points that they've gained from the primary sources, but this is the activity that they're doing. I introduced the primary sources to them in maybe about 5 minutes. They have to read them on their own. They have to mine them on their own. We didn't spend arduous hours of time reading through those primary sources together. What I do is I said, here's a task, make a skit. You have to make a skit. In order to succeed in this task, you need to mine these sources. And then we spent a day and the students performed the skits and it was a lot of fun. And students engaged in primary sources and made connections. Instead of lecturing on the reservation problems in the American, I live in Idaho, and those are issues there, right? But this is a different way of approaching it. And you see on page 2 is the lesson plan for it. Page 1 is the handout that students get. Page 2 is the lesson plan on the top of page 2. Page 3, different. I'm just working through my American history class. So we get through some of that stuff. We're moving into the 1950s here. Now we have a textbook that summarizes things. It was a mediocre textbook. The students actually read more primary sources than they did pages of textbook in my class. But anyway, so here's the assignment. You need to design a newspaper whose contents represent the culture of the United States in post-World War II era. Okay. Now, have I given them an overview of post-World War II era? No. This is my introduction to that subject. This is the first we've talked about the post-World War II era. This is their first off exposure to the post-World War II era. You're going to make a newspaper. And you'll find useful information, relevant chapters of the textbook. You can draw upon previous discussions and handouts, and you're welcome to undertake additional research on your own. Underpacking with more detail. Formatted like a conventional newspaper. And then look at points 2 and 3. Your contents must represent information about all 6 of these historical topics. And I list the 6. Korean War, communist infiltration, rock and roll, you see all that. So those topics need to be covered. And then point 3, the newspaper must include all 6 of the following sections or elements. Major news story, shorter news story, editorial, advice column, a cartoon, and a report on a sports event or a movie review. Your newspaper needs to have these components, and it needs to cover this historical information. I would suggest to you that those students are going to come away with a far better grasp of the post-World War II era. And then I'm milling around coaching, and we're spending several days, and they're making their newspapers, and they're looking at one another's news. What'd you do? Oh, what's your cartoon? I did the Korean War in the cartoon. Oh, yeah, well, I did rock and roll in my cartoon, and I did the Korean War in one of my articles, and I did. And they're having fun, and they're sharing ideas, and they're engaged in sources. Or I could lecture on post-World War II. What do you think? So, anyway, these are just ideas for you. Jumping to page 5, I do teach ancient history. We go through Assyrian sources and Assyrian inscriptions. So I have them read 2 Kings, which is that passage, if you're familiar with it. Sennacherib's army is on a rampage coming through, and then he takes all these cities of Israel and then Judah, and he's parked outside Jerusalem and just about to take Jerusalem, and then a plague goes through and ravages his army and he goes limping home, if you know that passage. So read that. That's the passage. And then here's the scenario. On the Kunjuk Mound in Nineveh, which, by the way, was just destroyed by ISIS a few years ago, on this mound in Nineveh, King Sennacherib is overseeing the construction of what he calls his palace without rival. That is what he called his palace. You are the court scribe, proficient in the mysteries of reading and writing. Prepare an inscription of the events of 2 Kings 18 and 19 that will please the mighty King Sennacherib. And then I've got some details. Look at that bottom check mark here. In your inscription, so I've given them some Assyrian inscriptions, and then this is what they need to do with the Assyrian inscriptions that are given. They need to produce their own, but they need to show me that they see the leader's relationship to the gods, the leader's relationship within his dynasty, and the students then are going to form and exercise their creativity and agency to do that. Or I could lecture on the Assyrians. Okay. Who's doing the work in the classroom? The students need to be doing the work in the classroom, and that work forms their habits and their intellectual dispositions and inclinations and how they're going to react to an intellectual challenge. And a student who goes through this kind of thing again and again and again and again has certain habits that are being formed that are going to seep into the character that we're trying to inculcate in them. All right. Do we have any questions? Yeah, right up here up front. Oh, and the newspapers, I'll grade the newspapers. Do they meet the criteria? I didn't do this, but I could have had them present their newspapers verbally, some sort of activity like that. Yeah, very good. Time for one more, and then we'll break if we have one more. Right in the back, sir. Do I communicate information? Oh, how do I communicate information? Oftentimes in the coaching, I'll come along, students run into snags, I'll explain something, I see a pattern of students running into snags, and I'll step up in front of the class and give a 3-minute clarification of a detail. Now, this is very important though. I have created in them a need to know that information because they need it in order to get over the snag that they've encountered. When I was coming of age, I played many years of soccer. I hate to work out. I hate to go on a run. I hate to lift weights. It's like digging a hole and filling it. You're not doing anything but moving it and putting it back, moving it and putting it back, and running. Like the scenery just goes by too slowly. But if you put me on a green field with goals on each end, I'll run my legs off. Because I'm not running, I'm trying to put a ball in a goal. So if you want your students to run, then give them a little ball to chase rather than say, hey, we're going to run. You see what I'm getting at here? And so with that newspapers, I want them to get some information, sure, but, I mean, I'll run to perform in soccer, but run for run's sake? That's in world post-war information for post-war information's sake? No, but I got to do the newspaper, so I need that information. Do you see the difference? All right. Very good. I will let you go. You've been a good group. Thank you.